हरिः ॐ सहना भवतु सहनौ भुनक्थु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिवसरि गौरभक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे Shri Chaitanya Charitamrita on Tulita, Chapter 2, The Chastisement of Junior Haridas, page 31, 32, 17 to 31. Desiring to deliver all the people of Bengal, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu entered the heart of Nakula Brahmachari. Nakula Brahmachari became exactly like a man haunted by a ghost. Thus, he sometimes laughed, sometimes cried, sometimes danced, and sometimes chanted like a madman. He continuously exhibited bodily transformations of transcendental love. Thus he cried, trembled, became stunned, perspired, danced in love of Godhead, and made sounds like those of a cloud. His body shone with the same luster as that of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and he showed the same absorption and ecstatic love of Godhead. People came from all provinces of Bengal to see these symptoms. He advised whomever he met to chant the holy names Hare Krishna. Thus, upon seeing him, people were overwhelmed with love of Godhead. When Sivananda Sen heard that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had entered the body of Nakula Brahmachari, he went there with doubts in his mind. Desiring to test the authenticity of Nakula Brahmachari, he stayed outside thinking as follows. If Nakula Brahmachari personally calls me and knows my worship of the mantra, then I shall understand that he is inspired by the presence of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Thinking in this way, he stayed some distance apart. There was a large crowd of people, some coming and some going. Indeed, some people in that crowd could not even see Nakula Brahmachari. In his inspired state, Nakula Brahmachari said, Sivananda Sen is staying some distance away. Two or four of you go to call him. Thus people began running here and there, calling in all directions. Sivananda, wherever is Sivananda, please come. Nakula Brahmachari is calling you. Hearing these calls, Sivananda Sen quickly went there, offered obeisances to Nakula Brahmachari and sat down near him. Nakula Brahmachari said, I know that you are doubtful. Now please hear this evidence with great attention. You are chanting the Gaura Gopal mantra, composed of four syllables. Now please give up the doubts that have resided within you. Srila Prabhupada. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakura explains the Gaura Gopal mantra in his Amrita Prabaha Bhasya. Worshippers of Sri Gaura Sundara accept the four symbols, Gauranga, as the Gaura mantra. But pure worshippers of Radha and Krishna accept the four syllables Radha Krishna as the Gaura Gopal mantra. However, Vaishnavas consider Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu non different from Radha Krishna. Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Radha Krishna, Nahi Anya. Therefore, one who chants the mantra Gauranga and one who chants the names of Radha and Krishna are on the same level. 3.2.32. Sivananda Sen thereupon developed full confidence in his mind that Nakula Brahmachari was filled with the presence of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Sivananda Sen then offered him respect and devotional service. 3.2.33.83. In this way, one should understand the inconceivable potencies of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Now please hear how his appearance, Avyapada, takes place. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu always appeared in four places. In the household temple, like so, he himself personally was present wherever he was in his pastimes, or he would empower his devotees. And now this is the third one, where he was praised because of Abhibhava. And he was Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who was always appeared in four places. In the household temple of Satyamata, in the places where Sri Nityananda Prabhu danced, in the house of Shivas Pandit during congregational chanting, and in the house of Raghav Pandit. He appeared because of his attraction to the love of his devotees. That is his natural characteristic. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared before Nrisimhananda Brahmacharya and ate his offerings. Please hear about this with attention. Srivananda Sen had a nephew named Srikanta Sen, who, by the grace of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, was extremely fortunate. One year, Srikanta Sen came alone to Jagannath Puri in great eagerness to see the Lord. Seeing Srikanta Sena, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu bestowed causeless mercy upon him. Srikanta Sena stayed near Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu for about 2 months at Jagannath Puri. When he was about to return to Bengal, the Lord told him, "Forbid the devotees of Bengal to come to Jagannath Puri this year. This year I shall personally go to Bengal and meet all the devotees there, headed by Advaitacharya. Please inform Srivananda Sen that in the month of Paush, January, I shall certainly go to his home. Jagannanda is there, and he will give me offerings of food. Inform them all that no one should come to Puri this year." When Srikanta returned to Bengal and delivered this message, the minds of all the devotees were very pleased. Advaitacharya was just about to go to Jagannath Puri with the other devotees, but upon hearing this message, he waited. Srivananda Sen and Jagannanda also stayed back, awaiting the arrival of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. When the month of Paush arrived, Jagannanda and Srivananda collected all kinds of paraphernalia for the Lord's reception. Every day they would wait until evening for the Lord to come. As the month passed, but Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did not come, Jagannanda and Srivananda became most unhappy. Suddenly, Nrisimhananda arrived, and Jagannanda and Srivananda arranged for him to sit near them. Seeing them both so unhappy, Nrisimhananda inquired, why do I see that you are both despondent?" Then Srivananda Sen told him, "Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu promised that he would come. Why then he is not arrived?" Hearing this, Nrisimhananda Brahmacharya arrived, "Please be satisfied, because I assure you that I shall bring him here 3 days from now." Srivananda and Jagannanda knew of Nrisimhananda Brahmacharya's influence and love of Godhead. Therefore, they now felt assured that he would certainly bring Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. His real name was Pradyumna Brahmacharya. The name Nrisimhananda had been given to him by Lord Gaurasundara himself. After meditating for 2 days, Nrisimhananda Brahmacharya told Srivananda Sen, "I have already brought Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to the village known as Panipati. Tomorrow at noon he will come to your home. Therefore, please bring all kinds of cooking ingredients. I shall personally cook and offer him food. In this way, I shall bring him here very soon. Be assured that I am telling you the truth. Do not be doubtful. Bring all the ingredients very soon, for I want to begin cooking immediately. Please do what I say." Srimananda Brahmacharya said to Srimananda, "Please bring whatever cooking ingredients I want." Thus, Srimananda Sen immediately brought whatever he asked for. Beginning early in the morning, Srimananda Brahmacharya cooked many varieties of food, including vegetables, cakes, sweet rice, and other preparations. After he finished cooking, he brought separate dishes for Jagannanda and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He also separately offered dishes to Nrisimhadeva, his worship. Separate dishes for Jagannath and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He also separately offered dishes to Nrisimhadeva, his worship of the deity. Thus, he divided all the food into three offerings. Then, outside the temple, he began to meditate upon the Lord. In his meditation, he saw Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu quickly come, sit down, and eat all three offerings, leaving behind no remnants. Pradyumna Brahmacharya was overwhelmed by transcendental ecstasy upon seeing Chaitanya Mahaprabhu eating everything. Thus, tears flowed from his eyes. Nevertheless, he expressed dismay, saying, "Alas, alas, my dear Lord, what are you doing? You are eating everyone's food. My dear Lord, you are one with Jagannath. Therefore, I have no objection to your eating his offering. But why are you touching the offering for Lord Nrsimhadev? I think that Nrsimhadev could not eat anything today, and therefore he is fasting. If the master fasts, how can the servant live? Although Brahmacharya felt jubilation within his heart to see Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu eating everything, for the sake of Lord Nrsimhadev, he externally expressed disappointment. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself. There's no difference between him, Lord Jagannath, and Lord Nrsimhadev. Vajumna Brahmacharya was deeply eager to understand this fact. Therefore, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu revealed it to him by a practical demonstration. After eating all the offerings, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu started to Panimat. There he was greatly satisfied to see the different varieties of vegetables prepared in the house of Raghavan. Shivananda said to Nrsimhadev, why are you expressing dismay? Nrsimhadev replied, just see the behavior of your Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He alone has eaten the offerings for all three deities. Because of this, both Jagannath and Nrsimhadev remained fasting. When Shivananda heard this statement, he was unsure whether Nrsimhadev Brahmacharya was speaking that way because of ecstatic love or because it was actually a fact. When Shivananda was thus perplexed, Nrsimhadev Brahmacharya said to him, bring more food, let me cook again for Lord Nrsimhadev. Then Shivananda again brought the ingredients with which to cook, and Prajumna Brahmacharya again cooked and offered the food to Nrsimhadev. The next year, Nrsimhadev went to Jagannath Puri with all the other devotees to see the lotus feet of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. One day, in the presence of all the devotees, the Lord raised these topics concerning Nrsimhadev Brahmacharya and praised his transcendental qualities. The Lord said, last year in the month of Posh, when Nrsimhadev gave me varieties of sweetmeats and vegetables to eat, they were so good that I felt I had never before eaten such preparations. Hearing this, all the devotees were struck with wonder. Nrsimhadev became confident that the incident was true. In this way, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu used to eat at the temple of Satchimata every day, and also visit the house of Shrivas Thakur when Kirtan was performed. Similarly, he was always present when Nityananda Prabhu danced, and he regularly appeared at the house of Raghavan. Lord Gaurasundara is greatly influenced by the love of his devotees. Therefore, whenever there is pure devotion to the Lord himself, subdued by such love, appears that his devotees see him. Influenced by the loving affairs of Shivananda Sen, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came again and again. Therefore, who can estimate the limits of his love? Thus I have described the appearance of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Anyone who hears about these incidents can understand the transcendental opulence of the Lord. Verses 84-100. Bhagavan Acharya, 82-84. At Jagannath Puri, in the association of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, lived Bhagavan Acharya, who was certainly a gentleman, a learned scholar, and a great devotee. Srila Prabhupada. For a description of Bhagavan Acharya, one may refer to Adilila, 10th chapter, verse 1-6. Udriki, excerpt from Adilila, 10:136, purport. Bhagavan Acharya, a very learned scholar, was formerly an inhabitant of Alisa. Yes. Hello? You were saying something.
Who's going again?
We are not understanding.
No, Maharaj. I'm doing about a page number and then I'm looking. Sorry.
Oh, okay. Bhagavan Acharya, a very learned scholar, was formerly an inhabitant of Pali Sahara, but he left everything to live with Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in Jagannath Puri. His relationship with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was friendly. Like that of a cowherd boy, he was always friendly to Srut Gosai, but he was staunchly devoted to the lotus feet of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He sometimes invited Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to his house. Bhagavan Acharya was very liberal and simple. His father, Shatananda Khan, was completely materialistic, and his younger brother, Gopal Bhattacharya, was a staunch Mayavadi philosopher who had studied very elaborately. When his brother came to Jagannath Puri, Bhagavan Acharya wanted to hear from him about Mayavadi philosophy, but Sri Damodar forbade him to do so, and there the matter stopped. Once a friend of Bhagavan Acharya's from Bengal wanted to recite a drama that he had written that was against the principles of devotional service. And although Bhagavan Acharya wanted to recite this drama before Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Swarup Damodar pointed out in the drama many mistakes and disagreements with the conclusion of devotional service. And the author became aware of the faults in his writing and then surrendered to Swarup Damodar, begging his mercy. This is described in the Antya Lila, chapter 5, verses 91 to 158, 3285 to 87. He was fully absorbed in thoughts of fraternal relationship with God. He was an incarnation of a cowherd boy, and thus his dealings with Swarup Damodar Goswami were very friendly. He sought the shelter of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's lotus feet with full surrender. Sometimes he would invite the Lord to dine at his house, at his home. Bhagavan Acharya prepared nice varieties of rice and vegetables at home and brought the Lord there to eat. Srila Prabhupada. Generally, those who invited Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu for dinner used to offer him the remnants of food that had first been offered to Lord Jagannath. Bhagavan Acharya, however, instead of giving him the remnants of Jagannath's food, prepared dinner at his home. In Orissa, food offered to Lord Jagannath is called prasadi, and that which is not offered to Lord Jagannath is known as amani or gharabhata, rice prepared at home. Because whenever they have festivals and programs, weddings, anything where you special, you're distributing prasad, they'll always bring from Jagannath temple like that, because you order before and then you get how much volume you want. So it's just a standard thing. You don't have other caterers in that. So if you cook at home, then it's garden pot. It's just house rice. 3288 to 89. Bhagavan Acharya's father, whose name was Shatananda Khan, was an expert statesman, whereas Bhagavan Acharya was not at all interested in the management of the state. Indeed, he was almost in the renounced order of life. Bhagavan Acharya's brother, whose name was Gopal Bhattacharya, had studied Vedanta philosophy of Banaras and had then returned to Bhagavan Acharya's home, Srila Prabhupada. During those days and also at present, Vedanta philosophy is understood through the commentary of Shankaracharya, which is known as Sharirika Bhashya. Thus it appears that Gopal Bhattacharya, the younger brother of Bhagavan Acharya, had studied Vedanta according to the way of the Sharirika Bhashya, which expounds the Mayavad philosophy of the persons. 3290 to 95. Bhagavan Acharya took his brother to meet Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But the Lord, knowing that Gopal Bhattacharya was a Mayavad philosopher, could not get much happiness from meeting him. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu derives no happiness from meeting one who is not a pure devotee of Krishna. Thus, because Gopal Bhattacharya was a Mayavadi scholar, the Lord felt no jubilation in meeting him. Nevertheless, because Gopal Bhattacharya was related to Bhagavan Acharya, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu feigned pleasure in seeing him. Bhagavan Acharya said to Sri Damodar, "Gopal, my younger brother has returned to my home, having concluded his study of Vedanta philosophy." Bhagavan Acharya requested Sri Damodar to hear from Gopal the commentary upon Vedanta. Swarup Damodar, however, somewhat angry because of love, spoke as follows. "You have lost your intelligence in the association of Gopal, and therefore you're eager to hear the Mayavada philosophy. When the Vaishnavas listen to the Sharirika Bhashya, the Mayavada commentary upon the Vedanta Sutra, he gives up the Krishna conscious attitude that the Lord is the master of the living entity and servant. Instead, he considers himself the supreme Lord. Srila Prabhupada. The philosophers known as Kevala Dvaitavadins generally occupy themselves with hearing the Sharira Bhasya, the commentary by Shankaracharya, advocating that one impersonally consider oneself the Supreme Lord. Such Mayavad philosophical commentaries upon the Vedanta Sutra are simply imaginary. But there are other commentaries on the Vedanta Sutra. The commentary by Srila Ramanujacharya, known as Sri Bhasya, establishes the Vishishta Dvaita philosophy. Similarly, in the Brahma Sampradaya, Madhvacharya's Purnaprajnapasya establishes Shuddha Dvaita, Shuddha Dvaita philosophy. Shuddha Dvaita. Shuddha Dvaita. In the Kumara Sampradaya or Nimbarka Sampradaya, Sri Nimbarka established the philosophy of Dvaita Advaitavad. And in the Parijata, Saurabha Pasya. In the Parijata Saurabha Pasya. And in the Vishnu Swami Sampradaya, or Rudra Sampradaya, which comes from Lord Shiva, Vishnu Swami has written a commentary called Sarva Gyabhasya, which establishes Shuddha Dvaita Prabhupada. So one is Shuddha Advaita, and Madhvacharya is Shuddha Dvaita. It's just saying it's only Dvaita. A Vaishnava should study the commentaries on the Vedanta Sutra written by the four Vaishnavas, by the four Sampradaya Acharyas, namely Sri Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya, Vishnuswami, and Nimbarka. But these commentaries are based on the philosophy that the Lord is the master and that all living entities are his eternal servants. One interested in studying Vedanta philosophy properly must study these commentaries, especially a Vaishnava. These commentaries are always adored by Vaishnavas. The commentary by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati is elaborately given in the Adi-Vida, chapter 7, text 101. The Mayavad commentary, Sharira Gravasya, is like poison for a Vaishnava. It should not be touched at all. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur remarks that even a Mahabhagavat, a highly elevated devotee, who has surrendered himself under the lotus feet of Krishna, sometimes falls down from pure devotional service if he hears the Mayavad philosophy of the Sharira Pasya. This commentary should therefore be shunned by all Vaishnavas. 3296 to 99. Srila Subhadamana Goswami continued, the Mayavad philosophy presents such a juggling of words that even a highly elevated devotee who has accepted Krishna as his life and soul changes his decision when he reads the Mayavad commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. And so, because the point is with the word juggling, they've worked out what sounds really nice and really attractive, and it seems like it's logical. That's the whole point, is it just, it's like political correctness, that it takes something that's not nice and makes it sound nice, or something that's nice and not sound nice, and depending on what you want to do. So it's just a matter of word jugglery. It's just how you put the words so that whatever it is you want to establish then sounds very logical and very proper. So that's why then one avoids these things, because they've worked very hard and thought a lot about this. They're just working how to make it sound nice, not how to establish God consciousness, but how to make whatever is their particular jugglery of words, put it together in a way that it sounds really, really nice. And because of that, then it says that one can get distracted. 3296 to 99. Srila Subhadamana Goswami continued, the Mayavad philosophy presents such a jugglery of words that even a highly elevated devotee who's accepted Krishna as his life and soul changes this decision when he reads the Mayavadi commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. In spite of Subhadamana's protest, Bhagavan Acharya continued, we are all fixed at the lotus feet of Krishna with our hearts and souls. Therefore, the Sharira Bhasya cannot change our minds. Subhadamana replied, nevertheless, when we hear the Mayavadi philosophy, we hear that Brahman is knowledge, that the universe of Maya is false. but we gain no spiritual understanding, right? Because you said Brahman is knowledge. Okay, great. And then you heard the world is illusion, right? But where have you gained actual spiritual understanding about what is Krishna's position, the relation with Brahman, the relationship to the world? You only hear those parts that they want. So, yes, there is the element that the material world is illusion. But that's how we see it. It exists. It's there. So, but if you're not seeing it appropriately, we'll see that's an illusion. You know, it's like the example from Mirage. It's not actually there. Right? But at the same time, as the mirage exists, you know. So then the difficulty will come up is that there's nothing to gain because you don't actually understand who you are, what the material is, or the world is, or God, and what is the relationship. You just hear parts of truths. The soul is Brahman, yes, but he is, you see, is that he's small and the Lord's great. The Lord is unaffected by the material world. The soul is. So they only take which part of the Shastra they like, you know, and then they present that. So you don't actually learn anything, right? It just sounds great, so you become bewildered because they only pick out which parts they want to establish.
Guru Maharaj, may I ask you?
Yes.
Guru Maharaj, does it mean that our acharyas, they defeated Mayavada philosophy in Vedic tradition because they accept Shastras, authority of Shastras, and by and because they quoted Shastras, they defeated it. But if we will take impersonal philosophical systems in another traditions, like for example Taoism or Buddhism, if they don't accept authority of Shastras, just by logic we can't defeat them. Is it?
No, you can. Because the point is their systems aren't logical. So through logic, you can use like that. That's all. It just, the point is that you're bringing it because they accept the Shastra, then, but it's still, if they're interested, the point is if someone's sincere and trying to understand the Lord and their relationship with the Lord, then when they come in contact with the devotees, then the chit potency will influence them. But if they're not interested, they don't want to know, then even whatever you say, it doesn't matter. So even those who follow the scriptures, if they're not sincerely looking, then they're not going to accept. You may have defeated them, but then they'll go back and try to work out another way, another angle, you know, to find fault in it. They're not accepting. So you see, like Prakashananda Saraswati, him and his followers, then they accepted what Lord Chaitanya said. And so then it worked out very nicely. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes, means logically it's possible, yes?
It means logic is there because they're using mundane logic. It's not that they're using spiritual. They're using mundane logic. So if you're clever enough at the logic, you can defeat them. But the weakness in logic is even you defeat them, then what you said can be defeated by someone who's even more clever. Chaitanya used to go through that exercise when he'd go down to the Ganga for taking his bath at noon. You'd go down there because all the students are there and they start arguments like that to, you know, test their abilities. Then he would defeat them. Then he would go back and defeat his own argument again. So he can get finer and finer and finer. So it's just a matter of how much you can. But the point is that's why I said that, you know, for the preacher, then they're situated nicely. So even if they can't defeat the other party, they don't get influenced. They know what's correct. They just don't know quite what words or what things to do or how to deal. Because with some people, the techniques of that, are they actually using the positive points of logic? Or are they using more rhetoric? Rhetoric is the technique how you win an argument or tarka. But tarka is not the main point of logic. The main point of logic is to come to conclusion. But they just like to argue. even if you do give conclusion, they'll continue the argument just to continue the taste of argumentation. As someone who's actually looking, then you can't. It's just like what we do anyway. We go out and we deal. But Chaitanya then, you know, defeated the person, I mean, all these different parties. Whether they'll accept or not is another thing. But when he went on his tour, then he dealt with all these. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you very much.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
Also, there is this aspect that because they don't accept the testimony, and that is, they accept only the perception and inference, which.
Yeah, so you have to show the logic.
Everything is based on their own perception.
So
yes. It keeps changing from person to person. So it will never have a commonality. It's never a match.
Yeah, because that's the whole point. They were bewildered, that's right. Because by being bewildered, then they move away from misusing the Veda. But then Shankaracharya moves them back, he bewilders them, so now they accept the Veda. But at the same time, as like you said, because it's all speculative, each one will have its own idea. And as Bhaktivinoda Thakur points out, the Mayavad philosophy, it can give shelter to any bogus philosophy. Because bogus means it's not in connection with the Supreme Lord and in its actual proper understanding. You know, like that. Because if you're not accepting that the Lord is the Lord of Shakti, so the Lord has form, it's actually atheism, even though you're quoting Shastra. But the attitude, the mentality that one has, the consciousness, is atheism. Right, because theistic, you know, that means it's about God and what is actually there. So actually only the Vaishnavas are properly theistic. Others may accept the Vedas and accept that there's a Supreme Lord, accept that there's God. But then the point is what do they do with that? So now they can take that and utilize that to serve, perform all the rituals and everything that the Vedas have recommended, so that they can come to the position of gaining, fruitive facilities, going to the heavenly planets or getting nice things here. But they're accepting the Lord, but the Lord is just part of their moralism. So they're moralistic theists, but their morality of being good and being nice, God is just part of that. So they may worship the Lord, but it's not that they surrender to the Lord. They worship the Lord just because you're supposed to be proper. You know, you're supposed to do these things, and all these are the correct things to do. But it's not that they surrender to the Lord, so there's no devotion. You know, they may be devoted to their worship, their rituals, but it's not that they're devoted to the Lord. And so that'll be any of those groups. So then religious processes that accept the supremacy of the Lord, and that, but then in worshiping the Lord, then the Lord is just part of that process for them to get the benefits they want. So we see is that it has that fruitive element to it. So many of the world religions, they have that element. But it's not that you don't have higher and higher levels, but that's generally the way it's commonly accepted. And even for many, it's accepted more farther down, where that it's kind of more of an imagined idea of what God is. But, you know, they have some faith there and all that because it just makes life better, right? So the difference is by believing in God, you know, God is good, you'll be better like that. And you'll get inspiration and all these kind of things like that. So you'll be a better person because God can see everywhere, so therefore you see. So they have their idea, you know, what God is here, or there, or he's this or that, or whatever it is, you know, so that the social construct works better. But then you see with the moral theists that, you know, the actual rather than the ones that are kind of like quasi-theists, no, God is there. The world is created by him. It's, you know, all these different aspects like that. And so you'll see a slight difference there because for the one, God is only part of their moral, social, religious understanding. Well, then the next level up, the Manavoy, then for them, the religious understanding and acceptance of God is the controller and all that. That's fine. But it's still, he's the one who provides. I surrender, he provides. I worship, he gives reciprocation. I surrender, he protects. You know, so like that, it tends to be a bit more businessy. Right? So anything that has that fruitive aspect can be there. Then you have the aspect where they're going to look at it that, you know, the material world's a problem, so therefore they go into the negative. And going into the negative, they tend towards an impersonal worship of the Lord. And they give up all the morality. It means they follow the Shastra, they're well-behaved, but they're well-behaved only because of the benefit they'll get themselves. Like that. So you wouldn't call them a moralist as such, because morality means someone else gets a benefit. But, you know, you're careful in behavior so that you don't give yourself any trouble, right? Then that's not a moralist, right? They're an impersonalist. So then in this way, you also have so many, you know, groups and all that. Then you have where you surrender to God, he's the supreme, we're his part and parcel, we're his servants. That relationship is eternal. We serve him in devotion. We're trying to develop love for God. That will be the third category of the theistic moralists, what they do with that position. In other words, Dharma is the basis of human life. Then you can use it in three ways. You can use it, Dharma for Dharma Artha Kama, or use Dharma for Moksha, or use Dharma for Bhakti, right? You know, to support Bhakti. So like that, then you're going to get to different mentalities. So there's plenty of logical things that can be said. Like you see Srila Prabhupada's books, he uses a lot of logic to express things. He'll show how it comes from the Shastra, but he'll show the logical aspect that you could use even if the person doesn't accept Shastra. So it's not that those who accept Shastra, their discussions aren't logical. They're logical, like that. It's just that logic is in support of serving the Supreme Lord. That's the point of this being made. Does that make sense? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Sroop Dhamma, he says, it won't change our mind. We're so advanced. Right? You know, so he said, here, because his younger brother, he went, he put in so much effort, he knows so much, he's such a great, you got the title of Bhattacharya. So Acharya means you're good at it. Bhattacharya means you're the best at it. So Sroop Dhamma replied, nevertheless, when we hear the Mayavada philosophy, we hear that Brahman is knowledge and the universe of Maya is false. But we gain no spiritual understanding. You won't gain any real understanding. Right? Because they've taken, because the material world is not properly explained, the living entity is explained, and you're only getting some features of the Lord as Brahman. You don't even have a proper understanding of Brahman. So it's incomplete on all of them. So what, and the relationship between them, that internal relationship, and you know, the willpower of the Lord, the willpower of the living, all that's not there. So you gain no spiritual understanding. You know, you're thoughtful, you're inquisitive in that, but it doesn't give you a basis. It's not that oh, if he's a Mayavadi, he has a strong basis for you know, Krishna consciousness. No, they don't. You know, because now they have all these ideas that just get in the way. And so with time, by association and that, and step by step, all these things will be cleared from the heart. The Mayavada philosopher tries to establish that the living entity is only imaginary and that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is under the influence of Maya. Hearing this kind of commentary breaks the heart and life of a devotee, right? It's just like, what's the point of this? Why do they say all this stuff? You know, you have Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur pointed out, one of the most, you know, amazing things is how the smallest thinks they're the biggest. How is 1/10,000 the tip of the hair? Unlimited Brahman. That there is no logic there at all. And they will claim that they're logicians and they're not sentimentalists like the Vaishnavas. So that's the Avidya Shakti, is that due to ignorance, they actually reverse it. Like if we say God is there, then let's say the scientists, they'll say, oh, that's just sentimental. We just work on facts. Okay, let's look at facts. Okay, so now we're looking at facts. So something is happening here, right? We have something organized. In the material nature, do we see have any experience of something being organized, you know, that somebody intelligently did use, do? Like you go to someone's house, it's all nicely kept and all that. How is that happening? By chance? No, it's by somebody intelligent, is that right? And so therefore, we have zero experience of it happening on its own by chance. And we have totally experience of it happening that people apply their intelligence and things get done organized nicely. So therefore, the universe is organized nicely in regulated laws, and they don't change. The whole science is based on these. And then they'll say there's no intelligence behind that. How is that in any way, shape, or form logical or intelligent? It's totally subjective. Right? What would be the reason not to accept that? To say that, no, there can't be any God. Why can't at least by the symptoms, it should be that, yes, there can be. Maybe you haven't seen, just like I go into the house. An intelligent person must have done this, but I haven't seen the person yet, but the possibility is there. So I will keep investigating until I find that person. So why wouldn't they do that? But they don't do that. That means they're not logical for all whatever they say. They're just atheists and committed to that. That's all. And that's a sentiment. That's a particular faith or a particular mood. And then they claim, no, we are, you know, objective. They're not objective because all the facts point to the one thing. How are they objective? They're not objective. You see, you go back in time, that there would be philosophers who would say, yes, it's God's creation. And as a scientist, I like analyzing God's creation. And those are the big guys that people generally remember. But at the same, you know, these other scientists, oh, no, there's not. It just happened by chance. And so if it happened by chance, that means the chance is always going on. Right? If it's there, it would be a regular thing. Why would it stop? So therefore, by chance, you would see just out of nowhere, then somebody just poink, pops up and, you know, hey, who are you? Like that. I don't know. I just arrived here. Like that, we don't see anything. In other words, anything happening by chance, we don't see it. It all happens by law. And so then to say something's by chance, like even they analyzed the theory called chaos. Because they notice if like water pours over an edge when it hits and how it goes and moves. But then, you know, with the big computers and all that, then after a while they map chaos. It's called fractals. And so then, you know, that means there is no chaos. So how would something happen by chance? That just means it's chaos. So if it is based on chance, that means then their whole science, it's not real. You know, they can say, oh, until it's disproven, we accept it as faith. So you can't disprove that there's a God. So therefore, you should accept it by that. But they don't. So that means they're not logical people. They like to play with logic and like to mentally stimulate themselves intellectually with logic, but they're not actually logicians. They may claim they are, but you can claim you're anything. I mean, you go to, you know, so many places in the insane asylums, there's always somebody there who claims that he's Napoleon Bonaparte or he's Caesar or he's God or he's Jesus. So, you know, you always have this. So what? Who cares? The babbling of the mad. But all these bad men get together and pat each other on the back, and so now then, you know, it's accepted. But otherwise, then no, we're not interested in that. Like that, because it's not logical. Pandurang Sharan wants to say something.
Maharaj, one reason is that in dream, nobody organizes anything, but we experience some organized life and experiences. So how do we counter this argument?
In dream?
Yeah, this world is like a dream. It's not existing. It's like a dream. And in
so
dream,
you didn't have a dream last night. There were no dreams. It didn't exist.
It's like a dream, Maharaj. They say like a dream.
Like a strawberry chocolate sundae. Like, but it's actually just a pile of dirt with some, you know, I say oil from the tractor, you know, poured on it while it was sitting there. But what is this like? How is that logical? It's like a dream. A dream exists. A dream, it has effect. So what is this like that... It doesn't exist. But then if it doesn't exist, why is there light? I say that there is waking, there is sleeping. I'm mentioning two different things that are individual. And then trying to, by showing individuality, show that there's nothing. It's all one. Or the silver and the shell, I'm showing two things. Right? And then saying it's all one. Right, I'm saying there's Brahman, there's the Maya. I'm showing two and then saying they're one. So in everything, they're showing two and then saying one. How is this logical? They're not logical at all. It's just Maya tricks them. That's the point, is this Maya illusion that they're talking about. They're exactly under that illusion. They just may be talking intelligently. Right? Does that make sense? But it doesn't mean they're not, that it's not wrong. They're not crazy. So that's the whole point, is just because they accept themselves as so smart. You know what I'm saying? Someone goes to the university, gets a degree in something. It doesn't mean that they know anything. You know, especially when you're dealing with the Vedic. Like just an example. That means you hear people who have, you know, studied and academically and all that on Indian music and this and that. When you hear them speak, it's just like they're saying the most foolish, stupid things that could be said. You know, like that, because they only accept those certain things. Like that. I mean, remember does that make sense? Yeah. So the thing is they just say, I remember I was talking to one big music guy, and I was mentioning something. He said, "Where did you get this?" And I said, "Well, I just read it in this," which I didn't mention the author, that says they're academics. Academics always come up with these weirdo things. They're not musicians, but they analyze it because I use my intelligence. I can analyze and I know everything about music. In fact, I got the PhD in it. So I'm more of an authority on music than, let's say, you know, Ravi Shankar or you know, one of these guys. But it means if you gave him a bucket and said, carry a tune in it, he would fail. So that's the thing, is it's not science, because where's the art? Where can they apply it? They can't apply it. They're not scientists. They're not academics. They call themselves academics, but they're not actually. If you can't apply what you're talking about, then it's not real. They go, oh no, that's theoretical, you know, physics. But you can't apply it. You know? So the point is, unless you know the art of application, then how are you able to apply it? So that's the thing. We're studying the science of Krishna consciousness, and the acharyas are giving it the art of application, and we're practicing it ourselves. So when it comes to philosophy, we are professionals. These other guys, they just talk.
Yes, Maharaj. Thank you.
Other sense? They're just clever at talking, that's all. Like you see, the biggest Mayavadis and all that come from South India. Why? Because they can talk nicely. The North Indian guys is, you know, cholega, you know, like that, you know, Haribol. You know, South, they can use their brains. So they come up north and they talk, and everyone's bewildered because, you know, they talk very nice. So that's right. It's just bewildering, that's all.
This is the main aspect, like when they're saying about dream and all, it's more like a poetry, because even if it doesn't make sense, it has to feel nice.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. They just, that's what we're saying. They go back, they say something that didn't work, they go back to either find, you know, some other way to do, or they say it poetic, a green bird and a green tree. It sounds fabulous. But as I said, the other day we were sitting here because the wind, it was morning, actually, the window was open so I could see the tree outside. And I saw the green parrot, you know, it was making noise all morning, go there by the tree. You can still, they were in front of each other. Right? I can still see it's a bird and it's a tree. You know, so it sounds great. That's the thing. It sounds nice. Yes, and you do this and, because you're that, you can meditate and you can become God. It sounds great. Who doesn't want to be God? You know? So that's the whole thing, is that it sounds, like you said, poetically, it sounds fabulous. It's ear candy. Or if they get more technical, it's intellectual candy. But that's all it is. It has no more substance than that. But because this is people want to be cheated, or, you know, people are, you know, innocent, or they're uneducated, then those who are more can talk all kinds of stuff as if they know everything. That's the whole point. But someone who can practically use it, then it's there. But if you have comparative religion, you know, then what can you say? If someone says, well, it's this, and that's what it says, that, but where's the authority? Are any of them practicing? You know, it's very rare. And the fun part is what I've seen is that those who their subject is teaching comparative religion and they follow a religion seriously, they actually are more inquisitive and more appreciative of Krishna consciousness. But the ones who follow and don't have any faith, for them, it's just an academic thing, and however they'd like to string it together, that's the way that students have to digest it and write their papers. Otherwise, they don't pass. It has zero to do with reality. It's simply their interpretation. Might be a few facts strung together, but then how they interpret those facts, what they want to do with those facts, the effects they want to see. You know, it's just like nowadays. Before it was equal. We were looking for an equal opportunity. It didn't matter if you were white, black, or, you know, yellow, green, orange. It didn't matter. You could come and you had an equal opportunity to take part in it. Then some say, you know, so there are those who, no, if you're not, you know, from this background, you can't do it. So then that will be, you know, socially not very proper. But then you see, so then, but then now it's not an equal opportunity. No, we want equal outcome. The guy who's a bozo and can't do anything, he should get the same outcome as the guy who's very clever and really works hard and gets the thing. This guy doesn't work much. This guy does. The outcome should be the same. So now it's getting really dangerous, because if that's the thing, then great. Let's bring everything down and figure out how much all these media guys and teachers and intellectuals are making, and how much that common person's making, you know, what's the average, and bring it down, bring it together. So just all you guys give up all that money, we'll just give it to everybody else. You know? So the problem comes up is that, just gets weirder and weirder and weirder. They're just going, no, it should be equal, equal outcome. It means all the kids study in the class, all the kids take the test, but everybody gets an A. Didn't matter if they passed or not, did or not. You get like that, these people will be useless. So you see in the Vedic, no, it's guna and karma. Right? You have the nature and then your karma, how much you apply yourself, what you're supposed to get from your past. And so therefore, that then combines them. And it doesn't matter your background. If you have the guna and karma, you should be able to do it. If you're blocked because of your background, that's wrong. So we say it's, oh, they're blocked from the background, therefore, then it doesn't matter and everybody should get the same result. No, it's guna and karma. Because you can't get away from that. You can say whatever you like, but the world runs on that. So that's what you can see. That's observable. So much of the time you see art philosophy and all that, if you can talk, very straight, the logical stuff, people that are practical in the world generally will appreciate it more. And those who tend to be more intellectual and, in their own headspace, they won't. Yes, so the point is that, people today, at least who claim to be, practical or intellectual, they like logic, at least a logical presentation. So we'll use that and we'll try to be as nice as possible and try to be as encouraging as possible to try to get people to appreciate and understand, the actual reality of what they're dealing with. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that we will adjust the facts or adjust everything because they don't like it. Because the point is who likes anything? What individual, like pointing out before, since it's all on the mental platform, each individual will have a different idea actually of what it is. So it's a basic, some principles that are there that allow people to speculate. And then because they like speculating, therefore they'll get together. And even amongst themselves, we argued. We saw, a few months ago, we were looking at the three Mayavadi schools. And in some of the principles that are in there, they're exactly opposite. Exactly opposite. And so that's the fun part. They all claim that they're following Shankara. So, that's the fun part.
Guru Maharaj?
How many Maharajas are we? Okay, Ananda Vrindavan.
I just want to add, Guru Maharaj, when you said about comparative religion study, in our university, only two people gave lectures on this topic, me and one old professor. And one day he attended my, he was a totally atheistic, he has atheistic views. And after his lectures, all of his students became atheists. And one day he attended my lecture and he said to me, tomorrow you will lose your job because in comparative religion study, we have only one rule that we should destroy faith in religion, but not increase this darkness in the mentality.
Yeah, they're just demons, that's all. That's the whole point is that, but I've seen others get theirs. I talk with another professor regularly when I go, I visit, and he's very, well situated in his own religion and this and that, he very much appreciates what we do. So that's the whole point, is it's meant to get rid of religion because they're intellectual, but they're functioning on the platform of anumoy. So it's just what they can see with their senses, that's all. They can't see God, so he doesn't exist. Of course, they've never seen the inside of their eyelids, but they somehow or another, will think that's there, So the point is that someone else sees it. So that's the point. We're saying the great sages have seen, persons have seen. They don't believe it. If I can't see it, it's not there. And they'll use their logic in so many ways. There's a creator, then who created the creator? Ha, 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 ha. See, I defeated. They're really foolish. So it's just anamoya. They're sophisticated. They're intelligent. They behave themselves so they don't create any trouble for themselves. But they're not actually, following the social norms like the pranamoya people, because they don't really care about anyone else. They only care about themselves. So if they behave nicely, they don't lose their job. They don't disturb people. It doesn't create any difficulty. It doesn't create anything that in the future could give a bad reaction. So in that way, it appears that they're moral, but they're not actually. They're just watching out for themselves that they don't get into trouble, right? You know, so it's some kind of, seemingly ethics. But the point is, morality is that is you are doing something that others are going to benefit by. Like that. That way you can have the greater social structure and everything like that. So like that, you see the intellectuals that are based on the Vedas and all that, and the intellectuals that are not based on the Vedas. That both of them, or even if it is, it's just about themselves. So of those who are willing to consider others, and one group is, God's important, and then another group, God's not. So that's what you have to deal with. Yeah, so it's just that the point is comparative religions, you're dealing with the religious nature. And so that's why it's famous, is that the universities, you go there, to get, they say you need to get educated to get a job, that's what it's for. But in so doing, they destroy any, human nature. You just become like the animals. You go out, you make money. At the same time is that if it is just about that, why would they be doing this? And if it's about, yes, you have to become cultured and refined and all that, then why is it that they're anti, why is there atheism? Because if you look at it logically, let us say, every culture of the world, they all have a concept of that there's God. What they say is God's another thing, but they all have a concept. No matter where it is, the most remote, any tribe, anywhere, they all have that. Right? But you're going to have these individuals like the professor you talked about, they're going to be against religion and all that. They'll say there's no God. Oh, no, but yes, that's in a primitive state. But then as you get intellectual and get more sophisticated, then you give up these, foolish ideas. But then the point comes down is that, but that's just your opinion. That's there. So therefore, when you're dealing with something, truth is one thing. Untruth, there's unlimited varieties of untruth, but there's one truth. So therefore, if you see it all people, then they're all taking the one thing that it is, that there's God, then why would you take it that that's not the human nature? And then certain individuals, then they say, no, there's no God and this and that. But, everybody accepts 2 + 2 = 4. Everybody. So it's one truth. And that there's some people who say 2 + 2 = 22. Or some people say, well, it doesn't matter. Whatever the child feels like it should be, it can be that, So those things don't matter. That's because you're not dealing with the facts. The facts is human life means there's a concept of God. Right? That's the uniqueness. So whatever it is, they spend their time so... Universities are famous for being the seat of atheism and to destroy all faith and authority. But if you don't follow exactly what they're doing, you won't get their grade. So they're trying to destroy authority that may be above them. But everybody below them has to follow their authority. So they're hypocritical. It's not that they accept authority and, therefore those below them must accept authority. They don't accept authority. They grudgingly go along with what the chair says so they don't lose their job and their tenure. But at the same time, if they get in position, they adjust it how they like. So it's not about absolute truth, these guys. It's about what they feel like. So it's completely subjective. You know? But they like to present themselves that they're the intellectuals and they're the objective, and everybody else is, you know, the sentimentalist. But they're totally sentimentalist. Why would you say you lose your job because you have some faith? You know, why would that, why, what has that got to do with it? What is that you're teaching compared to religion? You're in a place that has religion. You have a place where people follow religion. Why would that have something to do with your job? You know, you don't come to classes, you're late for classes, check the students' papers and all that. So that's something you lose your job over. You're not doing your job. How does your personal faith and how you deal have something to do with this? But that's the whole point, is they're not logical. This whole idea, this fallacy that all these intellectuals, they're logical. They're not logical. They're smart, they're observant, and so they're very clever. That you have to give them. They're super clever. But it doesn't mean that their conclusions are clever. Because what's going to happen, as we said, by the Pramana Chaitanya, they're able to perceive things and analyze things very nice. So they have very good ability there. But the whole point is, from the Pramitri Chaitanya, is the basis of how they're going to analyze it. They don't like God, therefore they'll analyze in a way to show there's no God. They like God, they'll analyze in a way that there is God. So it's all on the Pramitri Chaitanya. So that's the subjective element. You know, so if you're not speaking the theory that is popular today, but it's not about popularity. It's about what is the correct thing. So since they don't know, it keeps changing. So that's our advantage. We hear from Shravya, for those who are liberated souls. They don't make mistakes. It's not like these guys. And so therefore, then you base on that. And when you try to apply it with the Anuman, then it works. Because they use syllogisms that aren't complete. Right? They won't complete the syllogism. Everything that is in order is done with intelligence. This universe is in order, therefore it must be done by intelligence. They won't put it together. They'll go, everything that we do is by intelligence, but the universe, it happened by chance. And the fun part is, now on that chance, you're basing your whole theory, your whole scientific endeavor on that, the whole thing by observing something that happened by chance. And so if it happened by chance, that means it won't change. And if you say, it's the way it is now, okay, millions of years ago, it might have been different. Now it's like this. But then you're saying but at the time it'll change again. So they're not even interested in what's absolute that they talk about. So they're just speculators. And if you can speculate and get paid for it, you know, at a university, even better. Yes?
No.
Yes.
Yes. One of the acharyas, I think it's Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he comments like, Krishna's mercy is for everyone, but except those who are hypocrites. So the Mayavadis, their main quality is they're these hypocrites. Others among the six darshans, they follow what is important for them. But the Mayavadis, they say that Brahman is important for us, but hypocritically they don't accept the actual meaning of the Vedanta. That's why they are the most dangerous out of all. And then anybody who follows them, they are doomed.
They're very, yes, very difficult. Yeah. No, that's nice. No, hypocrites. That means it's just like Bhumi Devi. She can tolerate any load, not someone who's, you know, like that is lying. You also see in the Manu, it mentions that you have those intellectuals were like cats and those who are like cranes. I don't remember the exact details of them, but basically Prabhupada talks about the crane one. Both of them are there. The crane one is that is there, it stands and it's in its pose, like it's a yogi, you know, just meditating and all that, not moving, it's so peaceful and all that. But as soon as a fish goes by, immediately it catches. They present themselves in one way, but it's another. You know, same with the cats. They look like they're completely relaxed, but, you know, they identify that they're in control of it. So they're very envious and everything like that. So many bad qualities are there. But yes, they are very intelligent. You know, they're very clever, good with words like that. And so in that way, then it can be bewildering. So you have to stick to the fundamentals of what the logic is working. Because otherwise, if you go by what they go off in their poetry like this, then it then becomes very there. And like this one is there, you know, as Mataji mentioned, the guy's not even using an intellectual platform. He's just using threats. You know, you'll lose your job. It's kind of like, you know, what's it to you? You have your classes, I have my classes. You know, and so therefore, what's the problem? You know, he can't teach your classes anyway. He doesn't have enough time or enough interest. You know, so, you know, it's just threats. They can't actually, you know, intellectually discuss and then show that there's anything wrong. So that's the difficulty. The cheaters, they present themselves as very intellectual, very thoughtful, but actually they only think in ways that they want to think. Like that. You could say, well, everybody thinks like that. Yeah, everybody under the bones of nature does. But when you accept the path chalked out by the acharyas, then you can start to gradually, step by step, move yourself out of that way of thinking. We may still have it. That's why the Varnashram system allows us to engage our values that are there, but those values in connection to the Lord. And then eventually, then we're able to get them up. So as Srutanagar Goswami points out, the Mayavadi speak, there's nothing of interest there for the devotees. In fact, it's very painful because the way they speak with such arrogance and such confidence that, you know, God has no features, he has nothing, and whatever he does, that's all Maya and illusion and all that. But who are you to say that? You are a figment of somebody, you know, you're an illusion and you're speaking all this, and what does it matter? If you're an illusion, then, you know, like a dream, why don't you just evaporate? I'm awake now, I'm pinching myself. So you should disappear, right? But you're not disappearing, so that means you're real. And if you're real, then why are you making this philosophy? Otherwise, if you're just a dream, it doesn't matter. I'm going to go get myself a cricket bat. And then we'll see what's real and not real. We want to see, is your head real or not? Because if it's not real, I swing the cricket bat, hey, no, I'll just be swinging. Because the head doesn't exist, the cricket bat doesn't exist, my hand swinging, it doesn't exist. You know, the particular mathematical trajectory of the cricket bat doesn't exist. And so then there's no problem. And even if it does hit your head and your head goes flying, but it doesn't matter because it's all an illusion anyway. So that's the thing, is when you get down to it, they're not going to function at this level. They're just going to bring up some, you know, try to say that we're sentimental. When no, they're the sentimental. We're saying this facts, this material world is here, it's real. And ultimately, if they don't exist, you know, and this and that, and that's you say that, we say this. So, you know, and then there's the point that Srila Prabhupada mentioned to that, you know, professor in Moscow. So at the time of death, we'll see who's right. You know, and it's a good check. When that professor, when he died, right, you know, then, you know, these weirdo guys, you know, that don't look so great with their dogs, and that then they'll find out, wow, Swami was right, you know, because then if If you don't accept God, God comes to you as death. That's it. That's what Krishna says. For those who are atheists, God's still there, but it's death. Because you can say whatever you like and you're in control, but at the time of death, you can't control it. We're good?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Srila Prabhupada. Srila Swarup Damodar Goswami wanted to impress upon Bhagavan Acharya that even though someone firmly fixed in devotional service to Krishna service might not be deviated by hearing the Vayavada Bhashya, that Bhashya is nevertheless full of impersonal words and ideas, such as Brahman, which represent knowledge but which are impersonal. The Mayavadis say that the world created by Maya is false and that actually there is no living entity but only one spiritual effulgence. They further say that God is imaginary, but people think of God only because of ignorance, and that when the supreme absolute truth is befooled by the external energy, Maya, he becomes a jiva, a living entity. Upon hearing all these nonsensical ideas from the non-devotee, devotee is generally afflicted as if his heart and soul were broken. So he doesn't become deviated. It's just so painful to hear people talking like this, and they talk with such arrogance and confidence. So that's the difficulty. It's just, it's painful to hear all these things. So one doesn't want to hear. Thus, Bhagavan Acharya, greatly ashamed and fearful, remained silent. The next day, he asked Gopal Bhattacharya to return to his own district. Because he was saying, that's not, but then he's mine. Yeah, okay. So then he asked him, you turn back home.
Maharaj?
Yes.
Also, there is a principle that by just giving an oral reception, it itself is offensive. So because of that offense, then also the bhakti is affected.
Yes, yes. Because Lord Chaitanya didn't approve, because it's one of his associates would go and hear. And he would hear not because the philosophy was great. The guy was just a good speaker. He could speak so well, how he put the words together, you know, examples and all of that. He's just a very attractive speaker. But Lord Chaitanya didn't approve of it, so he stopped coming. So that aspect is just, it's just nonsense. Okay. Then verses 101 to 172. The chastisement of Chota Haridas. Right, so Bodhar Haridas will be the Namacharya. And then Chota Haridas is this devotee. 32, 101 to 103. One day, Bhagavan Acharya invited Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to dine at his house. Thus, he was preparing rice and various types of vegetables. A devotee named Chota Haridas used to sing for Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Bhagavan Acharya called him to his home and spoke as follows. Please go to the sister of Sikhi Mahiti. In my name, ask her for a mana of white rice and bring it here. Srila Prabhupada, in India, Shukla Chawal, white rice, is also called Patav Chawal, or rice that has not been boiled before threshing. Another kind of rice called Siddha Chawal, brown rice, is boiled before threshing. Generally, first-class white rice is required for offerings to the deity. Thus, Bhagavan Acharya asked Chota Haridas, a junior Haridas, a singer in the assembly of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, to get some of this rice from the sister, from the sister of Sikhi Mahiti. A man is the standard of measurement in Orissa for rice and other food grains. Right, so one mon, then is a certain amount. And then, so he's asking you to get that. So it's a decent amount. 32, 104, 106. Sikhi Mahiti's sister was named Madhavi Devi. She was an elderly lady who always performed austerities. She was very advanced in devotional service. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted her as formerly been an associate of Srimati Radharani. In the entire world, 3.5 people were his intimate devotees. The three were Srup Damodar Goswami, Ramananda Rai, and Sikhi Mahiki. And the half person was Sikhi Mahiki's sister, Udriti. Excerpt from Adi Lila 10.136 Purport. In the Gauranadesh Deepika, verse 189, it said that Sikhi Mahiki was formerly an assistant of Srimati Radharani, named Rangalekha. His sister Madhavi was also an assistant of Srimati Radharani and was called Kalakevi. Sikhi Mahiti, Madhavi, and their brother Murari Mahiti were all unalloyed devotees of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who could not forget him for a moment of their lives. There's a book in the Odia language called Chaitanya Charita Mahavakya, in which there are many narrations about Sikhi Mahiti. One narration concerns his seeing an ecstatic dream. Sikhi Mahiti always engaged in serving the Lord in his mind. One night, while he was rendering such service, he fell asleep, and while he was asleep, his brother and sister came to awake him. At that time, he was in full ecstasy because he was having a wonderful dream that Lord Chaitanya, while visiting the temple of Jagannath, was entering and again coming out of the body of Jagannath and looking at the Jagannath deity. Thus, as soon as he wakened, he embraced his brother and sister and informed them, "My dear brother and sister, I have had a wonderful dream that I shall now explain to you. The activities of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the son of Mother Sakshi, are certainly most wonderful. I saw that Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, while visiting the temple of Jagannath, was entering the body of Jagannath and again coming out of his body. I am still seeing the same dream. You think I have become deranged. I am still seeing the same dream. And the most wonderful thing is that as soon as I came near Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he embraced me with his long arms." As he spoke to his brother and sister in this way, Sikhi Mahiti's voice faltered, and there were tears in his eyes. Thus, the brothers and sisters went to the temple of Jagannath, and there they saw Lord Chaitanya in the Jagamohan, the Kirtan hall in the Jagannath temple, looking at the beauty of Sri Jagannath deity, just as in Sikhi Mahiti's dream. The Lord was so magnanimous that immediately he embraced Sikhi Mahiti, exclaiming, "You are the elder brother of Murari." Being thus embraced, Sikhi Mahiti felt ecstatic transcendental bliss. Thus, he and his brother and sister always engaged in rendering service to the Lord. 3.2.107-117. After begging rice from her, Junior Haridas brought it to Bhagavan Acharya, who was very pleased to see its quality. In great affection, Bhagavan Acharya cooked varieties of vegetables and other preparations dear to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He also obtained remnants of food from Lord Jagannath and digestive aids such as ground ginger, and also lined with salt. At noon, when Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to eat the offerings of Bhagavan Acharya, he first appreciated the fine rice and therefore questioned, "Where did you get such fine rice?" The Lord asked. Bhagavan Acharya replied, "I got it by begging from Madhavi." When Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu asked who had begged the rice and brought it back, Bhagavan Acharya mentioned the name of Junior Haridas. Praising the quality of the rice, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu partook the prasadam. Then, after returning to his residence, he gave the following order to Govinda, his personal assistant: "From this day forward, do not allow Choto Haridas to come here." When Junior Haridas heard that he had been ordered not to approach Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he was very unhappy. No one can understand why he had been ordered not to come. Haridas fasted continuously for 3 days. Then Srup Damodar and other confidential devotees approached Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to inquire from him, "What great offense has Junior Haridas committed? Why has he been forbidden to come to your door? He has now been fasting for 3 days." The Lord replied, "I cannot tolerate seeing the face of a person who's accepted the renounced order of life but still talks intimately with the woman." Srila Prabhupada. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur comments that Sharalata, or simplicity, is the first qualification of a Vaishnava, whereas duplicity, or cunning behavior, is a great offense against the principles of devotional service. As one advances in Krishna consciousness, one must gradually become disgusted with material attachment, thus become more and more attached to the service of the Lord. one is not factually detached from material activities, but still proclaims himself advanced in devotional service, he is cheating. No one will be happy to see such behavior. B2, 118. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu continued. So strongly do the senses adhere to the objects of their enjoyment that indeed a wooden statue of a woman attracts the mind of even a great saint person. The senses and the sense objects are so intimately connected that the mind of even a great saintly person is attracted to a wooden doll that is attractively shaped like a young woman. The sense objects, namely form, sound, smell, taste, and touch, are always attracted for the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and skin. Since the senses and sense objects are naturally intimately related, sometimes even a person claiming control over the senses remains always subject to the control of the senses. The senses are impossible to control unless purified and engaged in the service of the Lord. Thus, even though a saintly person vows to control the senses, the senses are still sometimes perturbed by sense objects. 3:2:119-120. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu continued, one should not sit closely with one's mother, sister, or daughter, for the senses are so strong that they may attract even a person advanced in knowledge. 43. This verse appears in Manasavita 2:115 and Srimad Bhagavatam 9:19-17. There are many persons with little in their possessions who accept a renounced order like monkeys. They go here and there engaging in sense gratification and speaking intimately with women. To the Prabhupada. One should strictly follow the regular principles, namely, no illicit sex, no eating, no intoxication, no gambling. In this way, one should make progress in spiritual life. If an unfit person sentimentally accepts vairagya or takes sannyas, but at the same time remains attached to women, he is in a very dangerous position. His renunciation is called markata vairagya, or renunciation like that of a monkey. The monkey lives in the forest, eats fruit, and does not even cover himself with a cloth. In this way, it resembles a saint. But the monkey always thinks of female monkeys and sometimes keeps dozens of them for sexual intercourse. This is called markata vairagya. Therefore, one who is unfit should not accept the renounced order of life. One who accepts the order of sannyas but again becomes agitated by sensual disturbances and talks privately with women is called dharmadvaji, or dharma kalanka, which means that he brings condemnation upon the religious order. Therefore, one should be extremely careful in this connection. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur explains the word markata to mean restless. A restless person cannot be steady. Therefore, he simply wanders about, gratifying the senses. Just to get praise from others, to get cheap adoration from his followers, or people in general, such a person sometimes accepts the dress of a sannyasi or bhakti in the renounced order, but he cannot give up desires for sense gratification, especially for the association of women. Such a person cannot make advancement in spiritual life. There are 8 different kinds of sensual enjoyment with women, including talking about them and thinking about them. Thus, for a sannyasi, a person in the renounced order, talking intimately with women is a great offense. Sri Ramananda Rai and Srila Narottam Das Thakur actually achieved the most elevated stage of the renounced order. But those who imitate them, accepting them as ordinary human beings, fall under the influence of the material energy. But that is a great misunderstanding. Om Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Shri Prabhupada ki Jai.